Well, tonight is our 2012 extravaganza. We'll be back with Andy Lloyd in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Andy, Ezekiel 1, tell me about the title, first of all.
It's named after a prophet from the Old Testament, Ezekiel. One of the books of the Old Testament is named after him. He lived in Chaldea, or Babylon, and was one of the sort of the Jewish population who'd been extracted from their homeland into exile. So he wrote during that period of time. He was a visionary, he was a prophet. It seemed to me to be a really, really good idea because he kind of linked sort of the Jewish thing with Babylon at the time. And I wanted to bring the sort of Mesopotamian ideas into a sort of Western context. So that sort of worked really, really well.
It did. Good cover too, by the way. Good artwork.
Yeah, it's an amalgamation of one of the Mesopotamian gods, the winged disc, and in the disc I've put an image from Soho, which is the satellite that looks at the sun, and if you look very, very closely, you can spot just a little anomaly in there, which is the basis for the book itself.
It's a novel, but there's a lot of fact here too, isn't there?
There certainly is. It's one of the idea of writing a novel is to put forward my sort of vision of the Dark Star and the Anunnaki and those ideas. I often find when I write about it on the internet or I talk to people, the thing that really gets them excited is the sort of speculative ideas that I've produced about how it all works and how it all fits together. And you know, it can be quite dry to put it in the form of a nonfiction book. You know, I mean, it's useful to do that because you can pull out evidence and you can reference things. But I wanted to sort of put together a package that would be sort of pleasing to read. People would enjoy it. It's very fast paced and get into it. But would also put forward a lot of these ideas, which are, you know, contextualized. They're based upon real events. They're based upon the snippets of evidence that I discuss.
Well, in a fictional book too, you, as you know, Andy, now you can get away with more. You can let your mind just wander, and you don't have to back up your theories if you're writing nonfiction.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's especially the case when you're talking about the kind of things I'm talking about. It would be very, very easy to upset organizations by putting them in the firing line of conspiracy theory, and if you do it in the context of a novel, then you know I can take a pop at NASA, or I can bring in some of the more sort of respected institutions in the world and discuss them in a sort of candid way without the fear of upsetting them, because it's fiction, and there may be a real point behind what I'm making, but you know, you're not going to have some lawyer come down on me and say you can't possibly say that because you know you can't back it up, what have you. It does give me a certain amount of freedom to write and enjoy the story and at the same time get people thinking about what may really be going on in the world.
Well, we'll get into it, but we won't give the last chapter away. Just for you. But tell me your thoughts about 2012.
It is a significant time. For our community, George, for our community, it's very, very significant because we're all very open to the ideas of other religions and other civilizations and the messages that they produce through myth. I mean, anybody who's reading alternative knowledge or speculating or trying to understand a broader idea of the framework of the world, you know, 2012 is significant. It's predicted to be the end of the world, and there's a specific date, and it's very, very specific, which is the winter solstice, 21st or 22nd, thereabouts.
21st, yeah.
Of December in 2012. So that's a real point of interest, and I wanted to explore that because, as we were discussing at the top of the program, there is an awful lot of interest in this in terms of, will this be the end? Will it be a physical destruction, an Armageddon, an apocalypse that will bring our civilization and possibly our planet to its knees? And I wanted to explore that idea, not just from the point of view of providing a solution to that, but also to try and understand that why people think that and how it sort of they get really upset and worried about it. So the story is set in the last 3 months of 2012, leading up to that date and including that date, and it takes in a lot, really, but it takes in the government attitude towards it, the way the government controls the media, the way they control messages, they stop things getting out that they don't want, the way they can use the media to promote a message they do want. It also discusses how they can control sort of scientific thinking, how they control, it's the sort of very much based on how governments control what people think and how difficult it is, with the exception of your program, how difficult it is to get an alternative message out when you've got this great friction working against you all the time.
True. Yeah.
So the idea in the book is once word gets out that and evidence is produced that something is significant and something is very real that's connected with that date, I explore the effect that has, the panic that creates, the anger that generates within a population and the way they react and the way that, again, is sort of subdued by the government. So there's a lot going on in there.
You center this around a journalist, which is interesting. Takeoff maybe on Coast to Coast?
Sorry, what was that, George?
You center this book around a journalist.
Oh, yes.
And, maybe a takeoff on Coast to Coast. You never know.
I wouldn't want to upset anybody. The hero is a journalist, but he's a journalist who is finds himself out of his depth. He's actually a chap called Bill Bainbridge, and he works for a London paper. And his general work is a restaurant reviewer, but he receives leaked information from our equivalent over here of the National Security Agency called the GCHQ, and that leaked information comes to him periodically and they make use of it in the paper. And it's actually leaked. The idea in the book is it's normally leaked by the government because they want it to be leaked. But he actually is in receipt of some information that is just right out there to do in NASA. And then the person who leaks in the information, she mysteriously dies. So he gets quite paranoid at that point and thinks, the last thing she sent me is this. I don't know what it's about. It's about Ezekiel 1. I don't know what's going on here. And she's died. This is very strange. I want to get to the bottom of it. And strangely, the paper that he's working for, instead of saying to him, look, forget this, this isn't the worth going for, the paper encourages him. And that there's someone who, the person who's running the paper, is sort of pushing him and saying, look, come on, there is something to this. You need to get the bottom of it. And so he's drawn into this conspiracy to try and uncover it, really as a sort of almost an unwitting fool, really. But he uncovers a lot. He puts himself in great danger. There's several incidents in the book where, there's all kinds of violent things going on. And he manages to get through that unscathed. And then the book sort of turns upon whether he sort of succumbs to the pressure to not believe by the government, that their fight to stop him from believing this story, whether it works or whether he eventually says, no, this is a load of rubbish, despite the evidence right in front of his eyes. So it's a sort of psychological thriller as well.
And as you talk about, there's almost an approach to control the press, the media, and you kind of highlight that.
I think this is very, very important. We live in a society where there is a very, very strong symbiotic relationship between government and media. And even in countries where we enjoy a free press, the actual extent of freedom that the press enjoys is limited. The press turns on either it's a publicly paid for organization like the BBC, which has no advertising, which then could be subject to government pressure in its own right because the government sort of owns it.
Sure.
Or you have organizations that obtain their revenue through advertising, which are generally paid through by corporations, and the corporations are tied to government. And so pressure can be used to promote certain ideas. And I'm sure in America, Fox Media is an obvious example to make. So, the way that the media is controlled by government within democracy is very, very important, because the media can put the message through, and people sit in front of their televisions 4 or 5 hours a day. They suck stuff in. It can be subliminal, it can be overt, but the messages that they produce, their sort of internal model of what the world is about, what their lives are about, is to some degree fed to them on a daily basis. So there's this huge sort of symbiotic relationship, and the two things help each other. And it's strange enough, it's during times of crisis like we're currently in at the moment, when that structure breaks down, that the money's not flowing, the advertising's not coming, and people, that the media itself can turn against the government, or it can start to have different ideas which are more radical, because without the money, the control seeps away.
It goes away, sure thing. Now, you know, you normally are a pretty no-nonsense researcher. The book's no nonsense, but it is a novel. Do you think that's going to open you up to any criticism at all?
I think it potentially could do, insofar as anyone who writes novels is effectively can then be stamped with, oh, this person's producing fiction, in a sort of Dan Brown type of way. Dan Brown took a lot of ideas that produced by sort of what you would call legitimate researchers, and he churned them around and created what was an incredibly wonderful story. And, you know, he's a fictional author, and therefore he's branded in that way. And so people reading his book say, well, it's just fiction, you know, there's nothing to that, even though it's based upon ideas that have got some kind of reality. But it's also, the other side of the coin is that a lot of scientists who are very sort of serious people also write novels, and they do so because, like I was saying, it gives them the opportunity to present their vision, or science's vision, of the world in a way that people can really sort of relate to. Instead of sitting down and trying to work through a paper full of math and jargon and scientific sort of high-mindedness, they can relate to a human story that is included. You know, things are included that will make you think, and that's what I'm hoping this will do. This will allow people who would not normally think about these things to question and to ask in themselves: Is my model of what's going on in the world the only model? You know, are there other possibilities? Is this something that's worth considering? So that's the purpose of it. But yes, you're right. There is a danger that. But my reputation as such could be sullied by it, yes.
What are some of the areas that you believe have come true that you highlight in Ezekiel 1?
Oh, right. Well, very, very strangely, I seem to have got myself embroiled a little bit with the KGB.
Really?
Yeah. The person who runs the newspaper in London, I decided quite early on, and I wrote this story over a year ago, that he would be a Russian oligarch. Now, in London, in the last 5-6 years, we've had a lot of billionaire Russians come over from the former Soviet Union and set up shop in London, live there, run businesses, and they have a sort of an ambiguous relationship with the Kremlin and Putin's Kremlin.
Right. States, too. They've done it here, too, I think.
Yeah. So I thought, well, it'd be kind of interesting to explore the idea of what would happen if one of these people was to take over a newspaper and be in a position to influence public opinion when they're actually got an origin in Russia. So I made the head of the newspaper, which is what I call the Daily Standard, the London Daily Standard, I made him a chap called Mr. Provotkin, and I made him a very sort of worldly wise Anglophile who was, a real gentleman, you know?
Or at least appears to be, right?
Appears to be a real gentleman. And someone who's obviously very, very interested in secrecy, intelligence, and seemed to know something about what was really going on in the world. You know, he was pushing his people at his newspaper to break this story, to break the conspiracy and get the story out there. And part of that, I wanted to sort of get the same feeling of the Cold War. You know, there was this Russian trying to break an American secret and so on. So it was a very useful device in the story. And then 2 months ago, on the news, in the business news, it transpired that the London Evening Standard, which was the paper I based the story on, was in advanced talks to be taken over by someone called Alexander Lebedev. And indeed, a couple of days later, he bought the paper for £1, which is worth even less now than it was then.
For £1?
He bought it for £1, yeah, which was actually around about the same price that he would buy a single paper for.
He bought the newspaper for that?
Yeah, I guess
he got the bills with it.
Exactly. So he's a billionaire. Now, what was even stranger about the fact that he was a billionaire Russian oligarch, which just fitted as well, was that his history prior to coming to Britain was that he was a foreign intelligence agent working for the KGB. Which is just amazing. I mean, you imagine, George, in America, say your New York Times or something like that being taken over by an ex-KGB foreign intelligence
agent. Could happen.
Well,
they're all having trouble now.
I mean, it's mind-blowing. And you talk about the way media controls public opinion, and your mind starts swimming with the possibilities there. Because Mr. Lebedev, and I don't want to get too much into him because, you know, the British media has reacted reasonably warmly towards him, not least because he's actually saved a newspaper from going under. So I think the media itself is quite pleased with him.
Good point.
And the government itself is sort of, well, we think this is fine. We don't need to investigate it. You know, freedom of the press, that's fine. So they're obviously pleased with him as well. But, you know, he's got this incredible background attached to him. And, you know, as much as he comes across as being someone who's very pro-West, he still has significant links with Russia.
How did he make his money?
Well, I think like all oligarchs, he invested in the monopolies that were privatized in Russia at the end of the Cold War.
Okay.
And then
unlike his friend who was running that oil company who crossed Putin, I guess he's doing okay, this one.
Well, this one is not, it's ambiguous, you see. He's not great friends with Putin, but again, he still maintains business interests in Russia. So if he'd crossed Putin, if they didn't have a good relationship, and of course Putin's, you know, KGB as well, you see, if they didn't have a good relationship, then Lebedev wouldn't have any business interests in Russia. So
exactly.
There's still that connection there.
And he'd be in the gulag somewhere.
Yes. Or someone will have taken him out. I mean, I'm sure you remember a couple of years ago, one of these oligarchs was poisoned with radioactive.
Yes.
Yes. And I can't remember what it was, polonium, I think it was.
Yes.
And, you know, someone came over from Russia, that's pretty clear to prosecutors, came over and put something in this man's drink in a restaurant, and within days he was dead, and he'd become the sort of walking radioactive waste. Really.
Put it in his tea or something, didn't
he? I think it was a drink. Yeah, they were sitting. He'd made this meeting in a restaurant in London. The two of them met. Perhaps they knew each other. I'm not sure. The story's murky. And then within days, he was dying of advanced radiation poisoning. And the perpetrator of the crime got back on a plane. He went back to Russia. There was traces of radioactivity on the plane. It could all be traced back to Russia. And then the story stops because the British were just unable to track this particular guy down. And the Russian, they knew he was, or they alleged they knew who they think it was. And the Russians just said, look, you know, go away. This is our jurisdiction. If we're going to find this man and prosecute him, that's our job, not your job. And the British and the Russians have been sort of in each other's faces for years since then. You know, it created a really tense standoff between our two countries. So again, you look at that within the context of Lebedev taking over this paper, and it's all the more confusing, really.
That's an amazing story. Andy, we're going to take this quick break. We'll come back and chat a little bit more. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines as well for you. Andy Lloyd, our special guest. Ezekiel 1 is his topic. He's also written The Dark Star, as we talked about the brown dwarf. He believes there's a binary companion star system in our solar system way out there. We'll be back. Hey, next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Andy Lloyd. Incredible work here, Ezekiel 1. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Andy Lloyd. Andy, you write about the Anunnaki in your novel as characters. I'm very curious how you injected them into this book.
Well, I wanted to give the impression, put the idea across that it's possible that there are aliens living among us. Now, we were discussing earlier on in the show about the Anunnaki leaving and just sort of clearing off back to their home world, mm-hmm. and then just sort of watching us, and you know, the idea of the biblical watchers, the Nephilim, that they would keep an eye on us but really not intervene in our affairs anymore. But I was also intrigued by the possibility that perhaps some of them stayed. And the main, I mean, obviously a lot of this is based upon the work of Zechariah Sitchin, in the sense that he, you know, put the Sumerian and Babylonian texts into some kind of context with living gods and aliens and so on. So I fairly loosely pulled out a couple of the characters from his work and said, you know, thought to myself, well, let's see how interesting this would be to make them part of the story. You know, it's taking part in contemporary life here. And what would they be doing? You know, would if they lived forever, what kind of context does that create if they were living within our society? How would they operate here without people realizing who they were and their significance? And would they become sort of powerful figures behind the scenes, or would they work on a sort of more maverick level? So I've injected those, well, at least one character into the first book, because I plan on writing two or three of these, because it's a long story that I want to tell, and this is just the springboard for it. But I've injected one character in that I think would be the most likely of the Anunnaki to stay behind and effectively try and guide us as a people.
Or left behind.
Or left behind, yes, indeed. Because, well, that's a good point, of course, because of the conflicts between them. This particular character would be the obvious choice for them to say, right, okay.
You stay.
You know, yeah, this is your mess. You clear it up. So, yeah, good point, George. I hadn't thought of it like that, but maybe I can write that into the next one, eh?
That would be interesting. Go ahead. You have my permission. Use it.
Thank you. So I don't want to spoil it as to who they are, because, you know, there are two of them in this first book. You know, as if anyone who picks the book up and reads it, you know, if that thought's in their head, they can try and spot it and see where I'm going with this before it becomes obvious at the end.
Let's move on now to the real-life Zechariah Sitchin and get your thoughts. First of all, tell me, what do you think of his work?
Well, it's something that stayed with me since I read it over 10 years ago. I mean, it really has had a significant impact on me. I mean, he's a tremendous scholar. His writings are can be a little bit difficult to read. There's no doubt about it. They aren't the easiest books to pick up and work through. But he presents just so much information, and he builds up this paradigm that for me has become very compelling. It explains so much. And, you know, I mean, one of the things that I love is when someone writes something and it predicts it and then it comes true. And one of the things that he wrote about in Genesis Revisited was that his vision of the solar system as described by the Sumerians,
mm-hmm.
You know, it created a description of each of the planets. And they were describing, you know, what Neptune would look like. And when Voyager actually went out to Uranus and Neptune and the data started coming back to us in the sort of 1970s, then the descriptions tallied with the work that he'd done on the ancient texts. And that kind of thing, you look at it and you think, well, you know, really, there just seemed to be something about that. Now, when I've written about Sitchin, there was a thing I did about 6 years ago that was a sort of a TV documentary that wasn't really designed for television, but it was a project. And I ended up, not face-to-face, but I ended up in a debate between myself and some Sumerologists from the British Museum who were effectively debunking Sitchin. And I was sort of putting the case for the fact that there may be some reality to it. And their argument was that they didn't think he could read the text. They didn't think that he was capable of doing what he said, which is sitting down with cuneiform scripts and transcribing them and understanding them. So I went to the what you would call the official translations of the Enuma Elish and read it. You know, nothing to do with Sitchin, just something that's online. It's there. You can read it. And as I read through, it was just plain and obvious. If you look at it from his mindset, if you explore the text with the thought in mind, is this about planets? Is this about gods who are You know, is this a cosmic battle between the planets? This is a description of his solar system. It became very clear what he was saying, because, you know, Nibiru was described in there, and it's described as a red star, and it's described as cosmological, or cosmological entities, planets and stars. And I thought to myself, what are they talking about? You know, how can they just say he can't translate it, therefore it's rubbish? Because, you know, the official translations can, it's a matter of interpretation. The official translations will also lend themselves to understanding the text in that way.
Do you think the Anunnaki might have also been the fallen angels as depicted in Genesis?
Yes, Genesis is Genesis appears to have been a Jewish, well, the first five stories, books of the Bible, I suppose, but Genesis in particular, appears to be something that the Jewish picked up from previous groups in the Levant area. And the Sumerians described the flood in great detail with the Epic of, and there was the Epic of Gilgamesh and so on, that discussed the same kind of event. They have their own hero, and it would appear to be that Genesis is sort of a loose translation of what the Sumerians had already been discussing in greater detail, actually. And they discuss how Enki wants to save them, and Enlil wants the people to be, you know, subjected to this flood. And, you know, the Jewish people, the Hebrews, appear to have taken that story and just sort of changed it a little bit into sort of a monotheistic way of looking at it. But, of course, in Genesis, they discuss the Nephilim, they discuss the Watchers, or the Elohim, and they use the plural for gods. That's remained, surprisingly, really, that's remained throughout their Bible, that there is this sort of polytheistic attribute to their early texts. And as the Bible continues, I mean, I'm not a biblical scholar by any stretch, but this seems fairly clear to me. As the Bible continues, the sort of monotheistic feel of it, the Yahweh interpretation strengthens. You know, the Hebrews move away from the idea of multiple gods and essentially they remove from their mindset the Watchers and Nephilim. But there they are in that Genesis chapter. So, yes, I think that is definitely a reference, a coded reference to the prior ideas of the Anunnaki.
Where does the devil come in real life here?
The devil.
I mean, if we talk about fallen angels, then we must talk about Satan somehow.
Well, I suppose from the idea of the ancient pantheons, Enlil, I suppose, is supposed to be Yahweh. So if there is a Satan, then he's going to be the person that Enlil's battling. But it's not clear, because there's a greater complexity to the stories that come out of Babylon and Chaldea and Sumer. And it's not clear that there is one specific god who's the bad guy. And I think that idea of there being a good god and a bad god, that came out of Zoroastrianism, actually, Ahura Mazda, and I cannot remember the name of the bad guy in Zoroastrianism, but that appears to have been the influence. It was more of a Persian influence that produced the idea of Satan, that there was, you know, this duality. There was the good god, Ahura Mazda, and then the bad god, who I'm sure one of your listeners will tell me who that is. And that appears to have been the influence of Satan, rather than something out of the text about the Anunnaki.
What has fascinated you the most about your work, Sitchin's work as well?
What has fascinated me the most?
Mm-hmm.
The possibility that our way of looking at the world is a model that's completely false. You know, in the sense that we as a species seem to deny the idea that we are part of a greater picture. And it's a natural instinct. It's a sort of anthropomorphic thing. We think that we are the center of the universe, and there is part something in our psyche that promotes that. It's a natural context. And as the centuries have gone along, we've had to give something up each time. You know, when the sun became the center of the solar system rather than the Earth. And then it just, we found out that there were lots of suns, and that there were, then we sort of argued, oh, well, there's not lots of planets. And then we found that there were planets around all these suns. And we, it's chipped away to the point where we are no longer the center of the universe. We are part of a bigger picture. And I think science now is coming around to the realization that, that you know, life's all over the place. It's everywhere. It's not just here. This is not a prime solitary example of a sort of biological accident. That it permeates throughout the universe, and it's just waiting there for us to discover and realize it. And that's the last point for us, really, to realize that we're not actually all that special. And it's that psychologically, as a species, I think it's going to be very, very hard for us.
These mysteries, Andy, that just make your mind wander and think are absolutely fantastic. I mean, from Sitchin's theories of the Sumerians to even your work with Ezekiel 1, the dark star as well. I mean, it's just incredible stuff, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, sitting from our normal point of view, I think somebody who had a completely mainstream mindset to try and get their heads around this all in one go would be, you know, it's too much. It's bound to look just completely out there, and I accept that. It's a gradual process in the sense that the more you read and the more you question and the more you open your mind to a different sort of form of ideas, It seeps into you over a period of time, and then you create this paradigm in your mind that is entirely different. I accept it is out there. I accept that a lot of people listen to this will go, this is bonkers. And, you know, I respect that. I'm not going to say, no, you must believe this. You must become a convert to this set of ideas. It is merely an alternative paradigm for people to consider. If they wish to accept it, that's fine. But it's something for them to step outside the box and look at things from a different perspective and see that there are other ways of looking at the world.
What got you to write the novel, considering the fact that most of your work and research was pretty hard?
I really did want to get a broader general feel. And also, when I wrote Dark Star, I mean, I'm very proud of Dark Star. It's a good book, and it's got something good science stuff in it. I really wanted to make a watertight book that debunkers would really struggle to get at. And Dark Star contains a lot of science, and I've extracted it from the scientific community itself. So I kind of, if you like, take their quotes or their papers, and I say, look, you know, these are the anomalies. You're saying this. This isn't me. This is science saying this. You know, look at the broader picture. Look at how this all spells out when you add it all together. And it was a sort of very serious book. Now, I'm very proud of it. A lot of people really, really liked it. It's created a lot of interest, and it's done quite well within that niche. But when I go out into my job and I go out and speak to my friends and I walk the streets and I chat with people, and if I mention anything about this, this isn't something that they can even, it's not on even on their sort of level of existence. It's too beyond. And I can't really sit down with them in 5 minutes and explain to them about this, and they just lose interest anyway. So I've given up with all that and I don't do it. But I wanted to put together a story that they could relate to, something that was exciting, moving, unexpected, would give them a lot of suspense and get them to really want to finish the book and find out what happens. And that's what I created with Ezekiel 1. It's got drama and a suspense, and even people who've never come across my stuff, because I've provided some books for some old friends and people that I thought they don't know anything about what I've written, and it'd be very, very interesting as an experiment to see how they relate to this book. And they love it, and they come back and say, wow, this novel's great. I really, really enjoyed it. I can't wait to find out what happens next. And the thing is, George, it contains the sort of material that I've been discussing this evening. And you've got an educated audience. You've got an audience who are listening tonight who have thought about stuff, read about stuff, have shown keen interest in trying to understand the world from different perspectives. And, you know, the people that I want this book to really appreciate, they've come away with that same thing. they thinking, you know, it's kind of interesting. Well, what if the world is like this? What if things are different from how I expect? That's impact. That's getting people excited about ideas. And for me, that's why I wrote the book.
Where do you get the book?
Oh, it's published by Timeless Voyager Press, which is based in California. You could go to timelessvoyager.com and read about that there. It is, of course, widely available through internet sites. Amazon hold it. There's a link on your site to it. And Barnes & Noble have got a listing as well. It's tricky spelling. If you're going to look it up in Google, Ezekiel, E-Z-E-K-I-E-L, it's very easily misspelled. But, it's widely available through the internet. And, of course, if people sort of click the link to my website, they can read all about it there as well.
You're an artist, too, so you did some work on the cover.
Yes, and I painted the cover to the first book as well. I mean, I've been painting for 20 years.
Good for you.
I think there's a bit of a link between people who've got this sort of creative urge and, you know, the interest in alternative ideas and paranormal and so on. And you often find, one of the interesting things I've sort of become aware of is that a lot of people who've got celebrity status as singers and painters and so on, I've actually had UFO experiences, or they've got a keen interest in this kind of thing.
They're truly tuned in, I'll tell you that.
They are. And this creative sort of thing, you know, it doesn't come out of nowhere. It's part and parcel of it. So, you know, my painting's a creative side, and the book writing, the novel writing's a creative side, and it complements the more serious stuff, you know.
Tell me a little bit more about the cover again.
Of Ezekiel 1?
Yes.
It's the Mesopotamian god, and from the winged disc, and
what is he sitting on? What is this thing?
The winged disc is essentially thought to be the sun disc, the solar disc, and the Mesopotamians is very strange, really, because they obviously were interested in this, the sun. I mean, it's the giver of life.
And what are those things coming out of him, like snakes or something? Do you see that? Is that behind him?
I'm not sure. I think what it is, it's that's a relief. The actual picture is from a relief, you know, which is, you know, it's a stella that he's constructed onto, and this winged disc that he is it's an enigmatic emblem, because the god is in the form of the sun, but as Sitchin has described, these winged discs take on a different connotation. You know, they could actually be an emblem connected with Nibiru, the appearance of.
He looks like he's sitting on top of a jet engine, doesn't he?
I know what you mean. Yeah, I think that's just the way I sort of created it, really. I mean, it's sort of interesting. We were talking about the Mayans tonight, weren't we, with 2012, and there's that fantastic tombstone in, I think, is it Chichen Itza?
Chichen Itza, yeah.
Chichen Itza, that's got that's got that Mayan figure who's enwrapped inside this bizarre construction. And of course, von Daniken,
Lord Pakal, I think
that's right. And yeah. And von Daniken was you know, pointed this out, that, you know, is this some kind of spacecraft, is this evidence for you know, ancient astronauts visiting us and so on. And you know, yes, I mean, the flying gods, it is interesting. And in the Indian text as well, you have the Vimanas, which are these, you know, flying objects that are described in their holy texts. You know, once you get into that, there's an awful lot of context throughout the world of ancient civilizations who describe these flying objects and the gods inside them. It's incredible, really.
It's all fascinating. Up next, your final hour, Andy Lloyd, and we'll take phone calls about 2012 on Coast to Coast AM.